Well, did you all know that our little community here in western Minnesota made the pages of the Washington Post last summer? Wow. Yes, indeed. Okay, so Madison wasn't mentioned, but Dawson was, and Montevideo was, and Granite Falls was, and the primary person that article was about in the Washington Post was my doctor, Dr. Virgie, from over in Johnson Memorial in Dawson. I would imagine a good number of you did know that we hit the pages of the Post, and also about the events that the Post was reporting on in that article, though I'm not so sure that these things have impacted us here at Calvary as much as they have maybe over in Dawson. I haven't heard too many of you talking about these things over the last year. But this has been a pretty big deal in our wider community, and to some extent I've been keeping my finger on the pulse of those activities, and I've decided today to add my two cents in to the discussion that's been going on. So we're going to take a break from our study of Hebrews here, and instead I'm going to catch you up on some of the events that have been going on in our community here recently, just in case you have missed out on that. And then I'm going to offer you some thoughts that I've had on these things. In the end, we're going to make some general comments on the topic of how Christians should relate to Muslims. Our Muslim neighbors like Dr. Virgie. So what got the Washington Post so interested in sending one of their reporters out to our neck of the woods here? Well, the things that have been happening in our community in the past year or so here have fit right into a struggle that is going on all over the planet right now, a struggle for non-Muslims to understand how to think about and how to react to Muslims who may or may not live nearby us in this age of the World Trade Center tower bombings and Al-Qaeda and ISIS and so forth. And on the flip side, the struggle also involves Muslims trying to help non-Muslims understand who they are, and that's exactly what's been going on here in our community. While these events echo things that are going on globally, my guess is that the Washington Post found our story especially intriguing because of our setting, right here in rural, white, Christian America, where Dr. Virgie might be, as the Post reported it, the first Muslim to ever live in Dawson. Following all the terrible stories about terrorists and ISIS and so forth in the news, and then also following an election to the presidency of a man who was talking about creating a Muslim registry in America, not allowing Muslims from some countries to come here, Dr. Virgie decided, after having been asked to do this, that it was time for him to get out and try to help his friends and neighbors understand who he was and who real Muslims are. And I believe this was back in late winter of 2017, just over a year ago, Dr. Virgie took the stage in front of about 400 of us Lacaparl folk in the Dawson Boyd High School auditorium, and I was there sitting next to Dallas Neiflot. And that's exactly what I heard from Dr. Virgie that evening. I heard him attempting to explain to us who he is, who his family is, and then I heard him say that 99.99% of Muslims out there are more like him than Muslim terrorists. He doesn't want to kill us, he told us that. It was one of his points, and in fact, I know from one of my conversations with him in the doctor's office that Dr. Virgie chose to come here because he had heard about how many small communities in America struggle to attract and retain good doctors. And so he came here purposely for that reason, to help people, not to harm people. I can testify he has helped me. He is a very good doctor. About the terrorists from ISIS and the like, Muslims who are killing people, I heard Dr. Virgie say that night of his speech that those people are crazy. And he said that they do not represent the average Muslim any more than the Ku Klux Klan represents the average Christian. He showed us pictures of his family, pointing out that in those pictures they were doing all the same types of things that we do, hanging out in the backyard like I was just talking about, going to all the same school events, going to vacations in Florida. My favorite part was when he showed a picture of their family cat sitting on their bed and said, "That's our cat. Does he look like a terrorist cat to you?" He spent a good deal of time showing how the Quran teaches Muslims to show love to others and to do good deeds. He recognized that about Christianity as well. He then referenced some Old Testament Bible verses that talked about killing people who don't follow God, saying next that both the Quran and the Bible have difficult passages like that within them. Now, he didn't shy away from the fact that he's a Muslim. During his speech, he talked so much about the similarities between Christianity and Islam that it prompted one woman during the question and answer period at the end to ask him what he thought of Jesus' teaching. When Jesus said, "I am the way and the truth and the life, no one comes to the Father except through me," from John 14, 6. And Dr. Virgie responded by saying that he does not believe that Jesus is the only way to heaven. So he was straightforward about his religious beliefs and the fact that he believed something different than almost every other person in the room with him that night, probably. I walked away from the event that night feeling that what Dr. Virgie had come to communicate to us was that most Muslims are not terrorists and that we do not need to fear or hate Muslims. That's what I heard him saying. Later on, Dr. Virgie got invited to bring this same message out to Montevideo and then to Granite Falls, and I'm not sure if he's done it beyond that or not. Well, this created quite a stir. Now, I don't know that anyone thought that Dr. Virgie was lying and that he actually does support violent jihad. I've not heard anyone say that, though I guess someone in the Montevideo presentation did shout out at him that he was the Antichrist. What I have heard from some people was a concern that Dr. Virgie's presentations might encourage those listening to believe, as so many people in our world today do believe, that all religions are equal and that there are many paths to God, in contradiction to what Jesus just said here in John 14, 6. And so then the fact that Dr. Virgie was not just stopping in Dawson, but he was doing more presentations, this caused some folks to start thinking about how they could counteract that potential implication from his message. So the result was another large gathering, this one in the Montevideo Community Center here just this past April 5th, where a Christian pastor and former Muslim named Sharam Hadian was brought in from Washington State to speak. I also attended that event. The title for Pastor Hadian's talk that evening was "The Trojan Horse of Interfaith Dialogue Between Christians and Muslims." The Trojan Horse of Interfaith Dialogue Between Christians and Muslims. So you'll be able to gather a little idea of what he came to say that night right from the title, although let me refresh you a little bit on what the Trojan Horse is. Trojan Horse concept comes from Greek mythology and a turning point in a battle in those myths called the Trojan War. And here is the explanation of it from the ever-handy and hopefully reliable Wikipedia. It says, after a fruitless 10-year siege of the independent city of Troy, the Greeks constructed a huge wooden horse and hid a select force of men inside of it. The Greeks then pretended to sail away, and the Trojans pulled the horse into their city as a victory trophy. That night, the Greek force crept out of the horse and opened the gates for the rest of the Greek army, which had sailed back under the cover of nightfall. The Greeks entered and destroyed the city of Troy, ending the war. So the Trojan horse was a trick. The Greeks made the Trojans believe that the war was over. They relaxed, and then the Greeks surprised them and destroyed them. Pastor Hadian came on April 5 to compare interfaith dialogue between Christians and Muslims to the story of the Trojan horse. So not so much a presentation designed to assert that Jesus is the only way to heaven, but instead a warning to American Christians to watch our backs. I'll try to relay some of what he had to say. We know that both Islam and Christianity are missional faiths. In other words, we're both trying to bring more adherence in to our belief systems. And we both at times, use strategies to accomplish that. Pastor Hadian came to talk about a strategy that he believes some Muslims have created, not just to make more Muslim converts, but actually to turn America, as well as the rest of the world, into an Islamic state. The strategy, he said, is based on a verse within the Quran, and I'll put it on the board for you here. It says, the verse says, "Say, O people of the scripture, come to a common word between us and you, that we will worship none but God, and that we shall ascribe no partner unto him, and that none of us shall take others for lords besides God. And if they turn away, then say, bear witness that we are they who have surrendered unto him." That from Al-Imran, and I have no idea if I'm saying that right. Pastor Hadian believes that the strategy of some Muslims is to find common ground with Christians, to establish a peaceful interfaith dialogue in order that we might relax, allow Muslims into our communities, allow them to go about seeking to enter into the American establishment, joining into the political system, the banking system, the school systems, etc. And then after a while, boom, they will jump out of the Trojan horse that they created and take over our society, turning it into an Islamic state. He defended this assertion in a number of ways. First of all, he referenced a monumental letter that was written and signed by 291 Muslim scholars from all over the globe in 2007. It was a letter written to the leaders of the Christian church everywhere. So here is that struggle I was mentioning before of, in this case, Muslims trying to explain who they are to the rest of the world, right? I'll read a good description of the basics of that letter that was provided in an introduction to the letter that was added to it a couple years after its initial release. The introduction said, and this will be on the board for you too, I believe, that this letter proposed, based on verses from the Quran and the Bible, that Islam and Christianity share at their core the twin golden commandments of paramount importance of loving God and loving the neighbor. Based on this joint common ground, the letter called for peace and harmony between Christians and Muslims worldwide. What was the title of this letter? It was called "A Common Word Between You and Me." So the exact phrasing there from the verse from the Quran, the saying of Muhammad that we quoted a moment ago. Pastor Hadian sees this letter as a grand deceit, and he frankly was outraged by it. He also appeared to be fairly angry that over 300 Christian leaders, such as Bill Hybels of Willow Creek and Leith Anderson, the president of the National Association of Evangelicals and a Converged pastor, later on signed a response letter that gladly accepted the words communicated from the Muslim leaders and also encouraged more conversation to take place between Muslims and Christians. In Pastor Hadian's mind, this was just another step of bringing the Trojan horse further into our backyards. Okay, now this wasn't the only piece of evidence that he offered to back up his view. He mentioned some documents that had been found that outlined this Muslim strategy to take over North America. It was kind of hard to track everything that he was saying that night, but I was able to find some of these documents that he spoke of in my research this week. And I'm not going to lie, this is some pretty disturbing stuff. I found reference to three documents that have been obtained by Western law enforcement agencies since 2001 that all talk about a strategy similar to what Mr. Hadian had been describing to us. And at least two of those documents, I was able to find enough attestation on the internet that I do believe they were real documents. You know, you have to kind of question this these days. But all three of the documents were written by members of the Muslim Brotherhood. So the Muslim Brotherhood is an organization of Muslims that's not tied to any particular country. But they seek, as they put it, to combine political activism with Islamic charity work. They say they are nonviolent, but many people have accused them of having ties to terrorists. When the group was founded way back in 1928, their creed stated, Allah is our objective, the Prophet is our leader, Quran is our law, jihad is our way, dying in the way of Allah is our highest hope. Today their creed is, Islam is the solution. There's no official number defined out there that says how big the Muslim Brotherhood is, though it may be in the hundreds of thousands worldwide. The earliest of the three Muslim Brotherhood documents, I'm only going to describe the two of those to you, was taken in a raid in Switzerland just a couple months after the 9/11 terrorist attack in New York. The letter was from a Muslim Brotherhood meeting way back in 1982. It's on the internet. I read it. It contains a 12-point plan to establish an Islamic government on the earth. The plan involves efforts targeted at controlling the local centers of power through institutional action to influence centers of power both local and worldwide to the service of Islam. It involves not looking for direct confrontation with adversaries, since that could lead to attacks against those involved in these efforts, and to support jihad worldwide. Second document was taken from a home in Virginia in an FBI search in 2004. It was a letter that was written by an individual in 1991 for consideration in a Muslim Brotherhood meeting that year. This letter talked about mastering the art of cooperation in order to accomplish a civilization jihad. And it said that the Brotherhood must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers. Okay, so there is some evidence to back up Pastor Hadrian's claim that there is this secret strategy on the part of some Muslims to infiltrate the American structure and eventually claim it for Islam. He said many things that night, but I believe this was Pastor Hadrian's main point. It was beware, right? So I went to two presentations over the last year. Dr. Virgie spoke primarily to tell us not to fear Muslims. Pastor Hadrian spoke primarily to tell us to fear Muslims. So what are we to think? Oh, I did a lot of reading this week. I wanted to see all this stuff for myself. I think we should back up here first and take a little deeper look at the common word letter from the Muslim leaders to the Christian leaders, and then we'll look briefly at the Christian response. Well, as is implied in the title of that letter from the Muslims, the writers of that letter did seek to find common ground with Christians. They focused in on how both religious traditions teach love for God and love for neighbor, and they did so quite convincingly. Why did they do this? Here's what they wrote. Finding common ground between Muslims and Christians is not simply a matter for polite ecumenical dialogue between selected religious leaders. Christianity and Islam are the largest and second largest religions in the world and in history. Christians and Muslims reportedly make up over a third and over a fifth of humanity, respectively. Together, they make up more than 55% of the world's population, making the relationship between these two religious communities the most important factor in contributing to meaningful peace around the world. If Muslims and Christians are not at peace, the world cannot be at peace. With the terrible weaponry of the modern world, with Muslims and Christians intertwined everywhere as never before, no side can unilaterally win a conflict between more than half of the world's inhabitants. Thus, our common future is at stake. And to those who nevertheless relish conflict and destruction for their own sake, or reckon that ultimately they stand to gain through them, we say that our very eternal souls are all also at stake if we fail to sincerely make every effort to make peace and come together in harmony. So let our differences not cause hatred and strife between us. Let us vie with each other only in righteousness and in good works. Let us respect each other, be fair, just and kind to another, and live in sincere peace, harmony, and mutual goodwill. What do you think? You just read those words. Is it a Trojan horse? Or is that a sincere effort to come together in peace? The letter also called for freedom of religion. Here's another quote from the letter. According to one of the oldest and most authoritative commentaries on the Holy Quran, the scriptural phrase, "None of us shall take others for lords beside God," means that none of us should obey in disobedience to what God has commanded, nor glorify them by prostrating to them in the same way as they prostrate to God. In other words, that Muslims, Christians, and Jews should be free to each follow what God commanded them and not have to prostrate before kings and the like. For God says elsewhere in the Holy Quran, "Let there be no compulsion in religion." This clearly relates to the second commandment and to the love of the neighbor, of which justice and freedom of religion are a crucial part. Later, the letter also says, "As Muslims, we say to Christians that we are not against them and that Islam is not against them, so long as they do not wage war with Muslims on account of their religion, oppress them, or drive them out of their homes." Okay, so are these statements truth, or are they deceits seeking to entrap us? In regards to the president of the National Association of Evangelicals and many other respected Christian leaders who responded favorably to this letter, let me tell you just a bit about what they wrote. So this response, and Pastor Hadrian had mentioned it in his talk, came about 1 month after the original letter from the Muslim leaders was published. I would imagine that Christian leaders felt a little time pressure to respond, since this was such a huge letter from Muslims. And again, this response was signed by about 300 or so Christians in leadership. It was more or less an affirmation that Christians agree with the values that were mentioned in the Muslim letter, the values of freedom of religion, the values of living in peace with our neighbors despite our differences, etc. And the response encouraged a continuation of the conversation between the people of the two faiths. So those who crafted this response treated the letter from the Muslims as being sincere, and they tried to respond in kind, writing, "We extend our own Christian hand in return so that together with all human beings we may live in peace and justice as we seek to love God and love our neighbors." So again, you know, what are we to think about this? Are all of these Christian leaders fools, as Pastor Hadrian seemed to imply in Montevideo a month ago, fools for believing this letter? So I'll offer you some of my thoughts. And please understand, I am no expert on this stuff. This week was the first time I have ever sought to research things on these topics. I don't have a deep background of having studied Islam, so I'm simply here reacting to the things that I have heard and in these two presentations and things I've read here recently. Thought number one is, I don't think that it should surprise us that there are people out there who want to overthrow America and create an Islamic republic. In addition to the many great passages in the Quran that talk about giving to the poor and caring for the sick, there are plenty of passages that talk about jihad. There are even passages that talk about the great rewards a person will get in heaven if they die as a martyr. So there is encouragement in the Islamic scriptures for martyrdom. And you know what? I don't think that's new news to any of us. Now, I think maybe this strategy that some Muslims have come up with, detailed in those secret documents I described to you earlier, that may be news to us. And yes, the strategy is disturbing and evil and, frankly, smart. It's a smart, pernicious strategy. There is evil in the world. Not a surprise. The evil people want to kill us. Not a surprise. Jesus taught that the devil seeks to steal and kill and destroy. Evil has not yet been vanquished. This is part of our reality in this life. It's out there. One of the big questions here, though, I think for us is how many Muslims actually are willing to deceive and maybe even kill in order to bring about the Islamic State? We know there are a lot, but what's a lot? A few thousand? Tens of thousands? Hundreds of thousands? We don't know the answer to this question. Boy, the common word letter certainly seems to be genuine when you read it. I looked through the list of the Muslim leaders who signed the document. I did find there one of the Muslim Brotherhood, one member of the Muslim Brotherhood. It was the man who was the general director of the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan. He signed the letter. So that makes you wonder a bit. There may be others on the list who have ties to the Brotherhood. I don't know. That was just one that had it in his actual title. Let me show you, though, or tell you a sampling of the titles of the other men who signed this letter, just to give you a flavor of it. So, the head of the Arabic Language Academy in Damascus signed the letter, as did a man who is the founding member of the Arab Committee for the Islamic Christian Dialogue. Other signers. A member of the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs in Nigeria. The dean of the Department of Islamic Studies at the Academy of Sciences in Iran. The Grand Mufti of Russia. A justice on the Nigerian Court of Appeals. The director of the Kuwaiti Center for Research and Studies on Kuwait. The Minister of Religious Affairs in Algeria. The co-chair of Islamic Studies at the University of Georgia in the United States. The editor-in-chief of the Sufi News and World Report. The imam of the Tarim Mosque in Tarim, Yemen. The professor of the sciences of tradition at Mohammed University in Morocco. The advisor to the president for judiciary and religious affairs in the United Arab Emirates. And a professor at the Department of Philosophy at Cairo University. That's 14 of the signers. There are 277 more. Awful lot of professors and philosophers on this list, educated people. So are all 291 of these people lying to us? Is this truly a worldwide deceit and none of them are leaking it or confessing to it? I don't know. So a team of researchers from something called the Bridge Project worked with that 1991 letter to the Muslim Brotherhood that called for a civilization jihad. And they took the phrases that the author of that letter had used, and they scanned Arabic sites on the World Wide Web to see if they could find chatter out there using the same terms that that author had used. But they came up mostly empty. Their conclusion was that the ideas found in this letter about infiltrating the United States were inconsequential for ordinary Muslim communities and Islamic organizations. That was their conclusion. Their theory being that there would be chatter out there about this somewhere if it was a really big deal. So I don't doubt for a second that there are people out there who want to conduct civilization jihad. I mean, the discovered documents prove that, right? But to me, the idea that the majority of Muslims in the world are in on this secret plan, and the idea that all 291 signers of the Common Word Letter who put their name to that document, that they did so in order to deliver a Trojan horse to us, that they didn't mean anything of what they wrote in that letter, but they plan to surprise us later with their covert operation, I don't know. I don't know how likely I see that. I mean, man, have you ever tried to throw a surprise party for anybody? You know how hard it is to keep 20 people from blowing that secret? Can you imagine if you're trying to pull off a global secret and at the very least you have 291 signers of a letter who were in on it? Don't you think somebody would have blown the secret or talked? And then we have to think about what we might call the Muslims who are we have to think about Muslims who are not members of the Muslim Brotherhood or any radical group, the people who are more concerned with living daily life than advancing the Islamic political agenda. You know they're out there. Don't you think that the odds are pretty good that the vast majority of Muslims don't actually want to kill us? When I worked at Wells Fargo in St. Paul years ago, I had two Muslim coworkers who I experienced as being friendly, intelligent, and kind men. They were fun to work with. We laughed a lot. I've experienced Dr. Virgie as being a doctor who genuinely cares about people. So, I don't know. You know what? If all Muslims are in on this Trojan horse thing, then they are amazingly good at deception. So is Dr. Verghese right when he says that 99% of Muslims don't believe the way radical Muslims do? I don't know the answer to that question. My guess is that 99% might be a bit too high, but I do think he's probably right about the large majority of Muslims. My guess is that we don't have to be afraid of the average, everyday Muslim. But I think we've seen enough here today that we ought to have our eyes open. And certainly our government and law enforcement agencies who have a God-given duty to protect us, they ought to be looking into the minority of Muslims who are dangerous. You know what, though, after having said all that, I don't actually believe that the most important question here is how many Muslims are in on the secret takeover plan. I actually think the most important question for us in all of this is this one. How are Christians supposed to fight? How are we supposed to fight? We've said today it's no surprise that there are people out there in the world who would like to kill us. So though we may not feel it in our day-to-day lives, we are involved in a battle. And the Bible clearly tells us that we are part of a battle that's going on both in the physical world and in the spiritual realm. So how are Christians supposed to fight in this battle? There happens to be some terrific instruction on this in the Bible, and I'm going to borrow a bit from a previous sermon of mine now to bring it to you as we finish up here this morning. The Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians 10 called upon Christians to battle against incorrect thinking and any false arguments that have set themselves up as a barrier between people and the truth of God. But then he says this, "But we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world." And Paul describes exactly what those weapons are for Christians to use in that familiar passage from Ephesians 6, where he tells us to put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground. Stand firm then with the belt of truth buckled around your waist, with the breastplate of righteousness in place, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Christ followers, we are not to fight with guns and with fists. We are not even to fight with nasty or angry words. We're to fight against evil with truth, with right living, with peace, with faith, and with the Word of God. Those are our weapons. They may not seem like weapons, but Paul has said that they have power to demolish strongholds. There is power in the Word of God and in speaking God's truth and in right living and peace and faith. These things can change the world. There's another very powerful weapon that we are to fight our battle with. It's the last thing you would ever think about fighting a battle with. Christ followers are to wage war with love. Jesus taught those who would follow him in Matthew 5:44 that you are to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. You know, if you think about all the people throughout the history of the world who have set themselves up against God and have cursed him and warred against him, how does God generally respond to that? We know there is a judgment coming when all evil will be put away. But how does he generally respond to that prior to that point? I think he responds to that by standing there with arms open, beckoning even those people to return to him. And if they will respond by turning and moving toward him, he's going to forgive. Because he loves them, that's why he would do that. God sent his son to die for sinners. He has love for his enemies. If we're to be God's true children in this world, we will wage war in the same way, with love. So if we are to show love even to our enemies, we certainly should be showing love to those of our neighbors who don't appear to be seeking to do us any harm. Christ followers of Lacaparle County, we absolutely should not allow the philosophy that all religions are equal, and that many roads lead to heaven go unchecked in our community. We need to be vocal and stand up for Jesus in this. This is true. He is the way and the truth and the life. But I'm going to be honest with you here this morning. I think we could have done a better job in our response to Dr. Verge's presentations. I'm not trying to say anything bad about the people who brought Pastor Hadian in, because I know their intentions were solid. And I'm not saying that the message that Mr. Hadian brought to us isn't an important one. I said that night that it was eye-opening for me. I stand by that. I learned some new, really disturbing things about the world that night. I did appreciate as well the few times he said in his talk that his intention was not to get us to hate Muslims, but instead that we ought to show compassion to them and seek to share our faith with them. But I will say to you this morning that, in my opinion, I don't think there was enough of that sentiment involved in his message. I felt there were too many statements like this one when he said that Muslims are flooding into Minnesota and they are coming with an agenda. Muslims are flooding into Minnesota and they are coming with an agenda. That is a blanket statement, putting all Muslims into one boat. And let's be honest, we know what kind of reactions a statement like that is going to stir up in people. In my opinion, the atmosphere in the room that night of Pastor Hadian's talk was one of agitation and anger, like we were getting ready for a fight. And I worry that not everyone there was thinking about fighting in the way the New Testament teaches, to fight with love and with peace. It was not a terribly peaceful meeting. I think we could have done better. Well, hey, if the Muslim Brotherhood can strategize on how best to spread their message, so can we. So what do you think is the best way to help Muslims come to see the truth of Jesus, whether or not they think like the Muslim Brotherhood does? Do you think it's by rejecting their offers to talk about common areas in our faith and refuse to speak to them? Do you think we'll have more success in getting Muslims to consider Christ by talking about all the bad within Islam or by talking about all the good within Jesus? You know, Muslims are people, and you know what I've discovered about people? They are way more likely to listen to what you believe about God if you have shown them that you genuinely care about them right where they are today, even if they do not believe in Jesus today. Pastor Hadian himself told us at his presentation that the reason he converted from Islam to Christianity was due to a Christian who accepted him as he was, who was a friend to him as a young man, and it opened the door eventually for them to talk about Jesus together. People of Calvary were called to fight and to stand up for Jesus. It's what our sign says right now. But I hope that we will learn to fight with love and with peace and with truth and with right living. And I hope that people like Dr. Verge, who come into our community here, will know that we genuinely care about them. And perhaps that will open up the opportunity one day to have a respectful discussion with those people about Jesus Christ and all that Jesus has done for any person who would turn to him. May God teach us and mold us and make us his. Amen.